This Do Lectures episode features the script developer, lecturer, and author of Do Story, Bobette Buster, recorded live at the Global Event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2012.
It started long before that. The opening line from Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, which is the 50th anniversary this year, and it was the most influential book of my childhood. And it's a story really about the United States' most embarrassing stain, the dark night of our soul, which is racism. And I come from the South. Harper Lee herself said, you know, the South is just peopled wallpaper, we're swimming in storytellers. And the state of Kentucky, I'm very proud I'm from there, has some of the greatest storytellers, the great orator Abraham Lincoln was born there, D.W. Griffith, who's the father of cinema, and of course the mouth, the poet himself, Muhammad Ali. And when I grew up, it was small town America, such as if you ever saw a Frank Capra film. And it was just very normal for anyone who walked through the door to say, oh, let me tell you what happened to me today. And a piece of pie would be presented and a cup of coffee. And the next thing you know, everything was off for hours. And it would go from a character sketch to something very funny, to a saga, to pathos, to remembering what it was like in the war. And there would be a pause, more pie served, I'd be sent to bed. They'd find me hours later asleep at the bottom of the steps with my ear to the door. And so I thought this was the way life was for everyone. And then in the 1980s, the US Library of Congress issued a call for grants for the last generation of great American storytellers were dying, and it was a dying folk art. And I didn't know that I had grown up in this phenomenal environment. So I applied for some grants. I was working with a professor of folklore at Western Kentucky University. I studied the history of the last 150 years. And what I discovered was my region of Kentucky, this remote steamboat town where they brought shipped in Charles Dickens books down the rivers and sent them on people on to New Orleans, that this region had been a region of Revolutionary War grant farms, and that it had been 150 years like a brigadoon, a snapshot of American history, that then became Gone with the Wind, a ghost town. So I was able to actually enter into the eras of my very young country. And I was able to go back and find all these elders. Well, most of them had died, so I found a few, including my Aunt Margie, who was 97 and had the memory of that was just extraordinary, of her grandfather, who was born in 1815. It was all very immediate. And as I interviewed all my elders, one thing came about, is that with Ralph Waldo Emerson says that within a few minutes, people tell you who they are and what has been important to them. And I would watch people come alive. They would become young before my eyes. Or a veil would cross their face, and they would be thinking back to the inconsolable griefs of their childhood, their adult years, the road not taken. Well, I also had a great passion for movies. This led me to Hollywood, where I work in development. Now, development is it's $1 billion a year conservatively. It is the search for the big idea that can become a franchise. And as you all know, Hollywood dominates the world with its franchises. It's a business strategy called synergy, which is meant maximizing a story across all of its platforms. Here we see Woody in Toy Story 2, who he thought he was just a toy in Andy's room, and he discovers in a parallel universe that he's an actual star. And this perfectly illustrates what Hollywood is looking for, is that big idea character they can maximize across all platforms. But what we're looking for as the audience is something very different. We're looking for the fact that we want to cherish a character's journey, identify with them, and take them into our lives. So what I discovered is I went on to become a professor of cinematic storytelling at the University of Southern California. And I teach a course on how you take any idea and take it into a feature film or a TV series or new media. And I was able to start to discern that there was a pattern to what made a great story well told. Now, I'm going to give you a few of these principles. First one being, take us to a world we've never been to before. I mean, how many of us have been to a galaxy far, far away, right? Take us on a quest. Can you hear that?
No more adventures. I'm not going that way.
And of course, George took us on an adventure. That film cost $11 million and I think has made about $5 billion. That's the business model we're in today. But the stories that are now dominating worldwide are stories like this.
Doctors, lawyers never get beyond 16,000 rupees. He's on 10 billion. What can our slum dog possibly know?
We went on the show because I thought she'd be watching.
She's my destiny.
Point being is what people are interested in is simply to be taken into a world they would otherwise never get to experience, and they want to see the ordinary become extraordinary because that's them. And so what happened is, from the Industrial Revolution, we got the great storyteller, Charles Dickens, who took us into a world we'd never seen before, which was child labor, through his loosely based autobiography, David Copperfield. And what he did in taking us into this world none of us had seen, we experienced a shock, a horror, and there was healing in the land because there was child labor reform. So the uses of enchantment can be very profound. But what I'm often told is, what you do is really not rocket, it's not rocket science, it's certainly not brain surgery. And I'll say, well, you know, it kind of is. Because Bruno Bettelheim, if you've ever read his book, was an Austrian Jew in the 1930s. He and his family were taken by the Nazis to Dachau and Buchenwald. He lost all of his family, and in a fluke of history, on April 20th, 1939, which is Adolf Hitler's birthday, several hundred prisoners were given amnesty, and he immediately immigrated to Chicago, where he became a pioneer in child psychology. And he wrote this book because he said that he had observed in the Holocaust that the children who had been taught the true grim fairy tales had been prepared for the fact that someday a wolf may come to your door. Someday you may be thrown in an oven, and someday you will be lost in the forest. But if you keep walking forward, you will discover the courage to find your way, and there will come mentors and allies and friends, and you will not only survive, you will thrive. Now, how do you tell that to children? Actually, fairy tales, folklore that comes down from long ago is there to psychologically prepare us for the future. So this leads me to several other concepts I want to bring up. Cinema has evolved as the art form of transformation. And people say, why don't they make movies like they used to? And I'll say, you don't want to see the movies they used to make. Cinema is a research and development business. The studios make 10 movies each. There's 6 studios in Hollywood. That's 60 films. 60,000 scripts a year are registered at the Writers Guild. The studios acquire maybe altogether another 500 films to release. Another 500 come to the United States and the same back and forth to Europe. 10% of those are maybe memorable, but 0.001% of those are great. So what we're learning through the process of trial and error is what are the uses of cinematic enchantment? And this is what I've discovered. I want to take us around to the Olympics, this being the season of Olympics in Britain. It was in 1972 that Mark Spitz was the first Olympic athlete to win 7 gold medals. But this is how he described the accomplishment. He said it was the mystery, the magic, the wonder and innocence. They were the personal seeds, the seeds of creativity in my personal story. He didn't talk about the hours of training. He didn't talk about the corporate sponsorship. He talked about it being imagination. 36 years later, Michael Phelps goes to the Olympics in Beijing, and this is what he says. The thing he's thankful for is his imagination. Now, you think this man is born to be a swimmer, right? But what he talks about in this accomplishment of winning 8 gold medals was his imagination. Now, Olympic athletes take this for granted, that with all their training and all the corporate sponsorship and all the coaching and all the gifts that society brings them, and they're already gods and goddesses, right? That they still have to harness the energy in their imagination, focus it, and take a fantasy and bring it into reality. And then there was the Australian Olympics in 2000. And it was this woman, Laura Wilkinson, who decided to become a diver at a very young age. And she got into it without really thinking about what it would become. But she, just before she got to the Olympics, she broke her ankle. And so her coach had her stand by the side and meditate and visualize every nanosecond of the dive. And on the day of the dive, they had built her a special sock that she put on and climbed the high dive. And she was in the zone that Olympic athletes talk about. She could feel her family smiling at her. And she dove. And she won the gold medal. And that was from visualization and meditation with a broken ankle. Now, in Japan, they have this temple called Kiyomizu. It's in the heart of Kyoto. It's 13 stories tall. And the Japanese have this expression they call daitansa, jumping off the Kiyomizu stage. And what that means is it is the moment where you stand consciously at the precipice of your life's choice and you leap. This is a life principle. It's not just something for athletes. It's not just something in storytelling. But the fact is, first of all, if I were wanting to really make a gazillion dollars, I should just stand outside and sign up all your life rights, because you all are doing great things. But I wouldn't be talking about what you've done. I would be going to Gavin's story, and I would be talking about the dark night of the soul. Because for us mere mortals, we're not Olympic athletes. It is in the moment of the darkest time when you learn, as children have to learn from fairy tales, how to walk through the woods alone. And what is it, and where do you discover the courage to win your life? Now, if you were doing my life story, you wouldn't talk about my public speaking, because I don't really have a problem with that. Although public speaking is apparently the number one fear in the world, next to fear of flying. But if you're doing the story of Prince Albert, the Duke of York, in 1936, he has this paralyzing fear of public speaking. And we understand why. It's because he has a horrific stammer. And of all times in history, if it had just been 20 years before, he could have just sat on a horse and waved. And if it had been 10 years later, there would have been film and they could have edited around him. But his time is the time when he has to rise to the occasion. And it turns out that the story is not about his stammering. The story is you have to follow the fear. His fear is really, do I have majesty? Am I able to rise to the duty? And the only way he's going to get through this, and this is what we have to isolate in cinema storytelling, is the moment a character crosses over a threshold. So let's look at just this one brief moment. The character has to do something, I don't know if you can see it here, they would never have done otherwise. I don't think you can see it.
They told me not to expect you.
All right, I'm going to move on. I'll just tell you what it's about.
I'm sorry about your father.
Sorry. The moment is when he has to leave his entourage, being a royal, he goes by himself to visit Lionel Logue, an Australian commoner, on the day after his father, the king, has died. And what he's doing is he's simply looking for friendship. He's doing something he would never have done before. So what you have to do when you're telling a story about someone is follow the moment that they most resist, their greatest fear. And what the most powerful moment in cinema is, what we can do in cinema is magnify and expand that moment where they seize their life. In that scene, it was really the moment when the Duke of York chooses to visit a man he would never have visited before and say, you know, I don't know you. Who are you? Who was your father? I've never met a commoner before. How was it life for you? And through the friendship with Lionel Logue, he's able to become a true king. Now, there's another great film, Shawshank Redemption. How many of you have seen this film? It actually fell off the screens when it came out. It was a huge flop. Sony did not know how to market it. It wasn't really a date film to go to a prison, you know, story. Lots of rumors of gang rape and all that. And it's a story about a man who has been in prison 40 years. And if I were to pitch this and I would say, you know what, this man, he's, you know, he really only does two things in the story, but they're really powerful. You know, he plays a harmonica and then he buys a bus ticket. And you know what the studios would say? Good luck to you. And we'd like to see that when it's done. But actually, the story is extraordinarily powerful, and after it fell off the screens in the theatrical marketplace, to Sony's surprise, across the world, by word of mouth, this film started growing and growing until colleges were having Shawshank Redemption Night, churches were having Blaze and Shawshank Redemption Night, and this is an R-rated movie. And the British Film Institute named it number 7 as one of the best films of all time. And really, the seminal moment here, and it's not going to show up on the screen here, but I'll just describe it to you. The moment that is the fulcrum is when Rad has just been denied parole after 30 years. He's utterly discouraged, and he says to Andy, I used to play a mean harmonica, but it doesn't mean anything in here. And so for a gift, Andy gives him a harmonica. He says, you're going to play it now? And Red said, no, it makes no sense. So he's resisting it. And when he goes into his cell that night, in the dark, he pulls out the harmonica and he just toots it for a moment. And then the screen goes black, and then suddenly the wall breaks through with light. Now that is a perfect depiction of what we all have to go through in order to gagner sa vie, as the French would say, win your life. What is the moment when you did something you most resisted, you didn't want to do, and you took a baby step towards it? And just in the doing of the baby step, you're not going to see it, so I'll just push forward here. That's the breakthrough in the wall. And just doing the baby step, as Goethe would say, there's power and genius in just doing the one thing. Just visualizing the one moment breaks you open. Now, the reason I bring this up is because this is a force in the universe, an inexorable force, that all of us, if you're going to do anything, the most important thing you all could do right now is tell the story to each other. And this is what I'm supposed to challenge you to do something, right? I'm going to tell you this. If you can today think about that time in your life when you were in the wilderness, when you had a dark night of the soul, such as Gavin has just described. If you can express this to one person, if you can say to them, look, there was that moment when I just did this, even if it was a failure, you can then embolden and encourage that person, because that's the power and the uses of enchantment and storytelling. In the case of The Godfather, Michael Corleone simply wants to have the all-American dream. He's come home from war as a World War II hero. But it falls to him to have to, he thinks, save his father's life. And we're not going to be able to see this scene either, so I'm just going to describe it to you. But it's a scene in which he is agonizing over the choice that he doesn't want to make. And what it is we have 17 minutes in The Godfather, where we see Michael Corleone basically resisting this destiny and going into the bathroom and taking the gun, and he goes through these doors and he's like, no. And he comes out and he still can't kill the men who he feels he has to kill, because they're going to come after his father, Vito Corleone. And the sound design is of his screaming subway, but what it really is his heart is screaming and screaming. And as soon as he kills the men, the look on his face is he becomes the living dead. And from thereafter, Michael Corleone, its story is a tragedy of epic proportions. And this is why we love cinema, because it's really teasing out those moments in our lives where if we didn't make the choice, and this is the key point, the choice you make is the one you resist that will set you free. the greatest stories were all about a character resisting loving themselves. So in the United States, there was this woman, Sojourner Truth, who basically was a slave, and she emancipated, got herself emancipated, and then went to court and got her children emancipated. And then she got 1,000 slaves out of the South to the North during the Civil War, and she said she could have gotten thousands more if they had known they were slaves. The point is that our imaginations are shrink-wrapped. What we have to do is break through that imagination that people really have and want to have and explore. That's the uses of enchantment. And it was to return to the great national sin of the United States, it was Mahatma Gandhi's story that inspired Martin Luther King. Now, we had lived with racism and segregation for 350 years, and what happens to any society is you adapt to that. Like a frog, you know, if you put the frog in room temperature water and you start to boil it, the frog will jump out. But if you put the frog in, no, I'd said it the wrong way. If you put the frog in boiling water, it will jump out. If you put it in room temperature water and start to boil the water, it adapts. And so in any society, we are all adapting to the status quo at all times. When do we wake up and jump out? And so what Martin Luther King did is, observing the story of what Mahatma Gandhi had done in India, he spoke up finally to the United States, and he said to the whites in the United States, he said, "I appeal to your conscience. This is wrong." But what he said to the black community in the United States is, and this is critical, we had adapted to the use of this word, which I can no longer say, it's called the N-word. That had become the reality in the United States. And he said to the black community, until you love yourself, until you think you're beautiful, you will not change the world. You must be the change you want to be. And that is the critical thing in storytelling, is you're watching someone open up their imagination, focus with intention on what they want, and take a step towards their true destiny. Because ultimately, all stories are about watching someone become fully alive or the living dead. And finally, I'd like to say that it was Samuel Beckett who said, the great expatriate Irishman himself, "It doesn't matter if you're trying and you fail, try again and fail better. Such are the forces of trying." And it was Camus who said, "The purpose of the storyteller is to keep civilization from destroying itself." So I hope you will all tell your stories today to each other at the pub. Thank you.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or, if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out. For our weekly curation of wonder and optimism, sign up to our newsletter by visiting thedolectures.com/newsletter.